Now, it is my understanding that a biography has been written of me, the first ever biography written of me, by somebody by the name of Edward Dutton. I don't know who he is, but you should all buy it. You should buy it if you want a greater... I think it was Benjamin Disraeli. Benjamin Disraeli. He was one of them. And Benjamin Disraeli, he said, if a book is worth reading, it's worth buying. And this is a book, from what I can work out, about my life, warts and all, that is worth reading and is therefore worth buying, because I regret nothing. I regret nothing of my life, and I want you all to read about it. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, I've just published the first ever biography, and indeed official biography, of Jonathan Bowden, a person who, even in the act of publishing it, I have discovered is far more influential, far more liked, far more worshipped even, than even I had imagined. And I have spent months researching everything I can about him. So I want to tell you today, I want to give you a sort of behind-the-scenes insight into how that biography came about and the various difficult mountain passes I have had to climb along, gripping the wall, in order to finish it. But before I do that, could you do me a favour? Could you please, please, please subscribe? Could you subscribe here on YouTube, and could you leave a like and hit the bell button and all that stuff? Could you basically help the algorithm? It really helps if you do that. And could you subscribe on my Substack, which is jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based interviews, in-person interviews, all kinds of stuff, films I make, vlogs, writings, and where if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of just a pint of beer a month, the kind of pint of beer you might have drunk if you've been at a Bowden speech in 2009 above an English pub. So, okay, back to the video. So how did it happen? Well, in 2019, when I really just started The Jolly Heretic, and I had a live stream, as many of you will remember, with Michael Woodley, somebody said on the live stream one day, you should write a biography of Jonathan Bowden. The guy had already written a few biographies. I'd written a biography of J. Philippe Rushton, for example, who is a sort of based psychologist. And I'd written a biography of Churchill's prep school headmaster, where I interrogated some of the myths and exaggerations about him. It's called Churchill's Headmaster, the Sadist Nearly Saved the British Empire. So, and I've written a number of obituaries as well for the Mankind Quarterly and other places. So it was known that I was quite interested in this. Now, I didn't know of Jonathan Bowden during his lifetime. When he came to the heights of his fame within life, which was the mid-noughties to the mid-tens, I was already living in Finland. So I wasn't familiar with any of this, the New Right Forum, where he used to go and speak in London. And then only the other day I passed, what was it called, the Victory Club? It was somewhere near Waterloo Station. I was near Waterloo, and I happened to walk past it. And I knew that he'd spoken there. And then right next to there was a fish and chip shop. This is behind Waterloo Station, towards the cut, towards that kind of area. And there was a fish and chip shop called Fiscotech, where apparently he used to dine. So there you are. And I didn't know of him. I first discovered him. I was at a meeting of the London Conference on Intelligence in 2015 in central London. And there was some chap that had come along, and he and somebody else were talking about Jonathan Bowden and how he was such an amazing, I didn't even know he was dead, such an incredible speaker, that he had such an ability to distill knowledge down to its essence and to bring together obscure strands, esoteric strands of knowledge, and to sort of make you feel like you were there and that you really understood something that had heretofore been totally obscure. An example being Julius Evola, who at that point I hadn't even heard of, or I'd vaguely heard of. So I thought, well, that would be interesting. I'd like to see what he has to say about this Julius Evola. So I found his speech from above a pub on YouTube, and I thought this is very interesting, and it brought it in an engaging fashion, so that I really felt I understood it in an absorbing fashion, so it wasn't just reading cold prose. The essence of this guy's philosophy and the essence of this guy's personality, delivered by a very charismatic, personable, interesting, funny guy, so that you really feel that you've taken this information in and you've been taken in by a journey, on a journey by him. And there was something kind of semi-hypnotic about it. I thought he was a very interesting guy. And I Googled him and discovered that he died. I had no idea that he died, and that he was only 49, which was shocking. And then I sort of began watching more and more speeches by him, again, on some people I'd never even heard of, or on some that I had, but they were elucidated in an interesting way. And then I found some of them to be more political in nature, and he was just so adept at taking you into his world, taking you on a journey into his world, and kind of inspiring you about the nature of, the clown world will be triumphed over in the end, this sort of thing. So I was vaguely interested in him. By the time in 2019, people said, oh, you should write his biography. I'd really love to see your biography of him. But it turned out I got in touch with I asked around. I found out who the person was who was his best friend, to whom he left all of his paintings, because he did about 300 paintings or 200 paintings. And all of his literary executor, as it were, a guy called Michael Woodbridge, who was a sort of retired political activist in his late 70s. And he said, no, it's already being written by somebody else. And that person's been writing it. This was in 2019, since 2012. And so I assumed, Donald Bowden died in 2012. So presumably this will be out by 2022 and he's writing it. So I can't write it and he has access. So I got in touch with this guy. I mentioned it was his name in the book, a guy called Alex Kurtajic. And I said, well, so you're writing it, are you? Yes, I am, he said. And then in 2021, again, and this, by now we're a year before the 10th anniversary. And surely if you've got 10 years to write a book, you're going to get it out in time for the 10th anniversary of the guy's death. I contact him. Oh, he's still writing it. He's still writing it. And so I just, again, just stopped thinking about it, really. And then time passes. He still hasn't written it. He still hasn't written it. I get other people start again asking me. This was in 2023. If I could write it, but the problem is that there's someone already writing it. So what's the point of writing a book if there's someone already writing it? He still hasn't written it. And eventually, one day in September of 2024. I was at a meeting of what I would call a purple pilled online magazine, the kind of magazine where the people that write for it know perfectly well what the empirical truth is, but won't quite go there. Well, they'll go there after a few drinks, but they'll pretend that overtly that they're not quite sure, maybe it's a bit complicated and all of this kind of nonsense. And I went to this meeting and I got talking. I sat down next to this girl who's a bit older than me, who's a philosopher. And I didn't know who she was. I knew her name, but I didn't know what she looked like. But she knew who I was and recognised me. And I said, oh, I'm Ed Dutt. She said, oh, I know who you are. And then she got out of her handbag a copy of Extremists, which is a book of Jonathan Bowden's speeches, with him on the front brandishing two revolvers, and looked at me with undisguised pride, gleaming, as if to say, hey, look Ed, look how based I am. I bet you didn't think I had it in me. And at this point, I thought, cripes, maybe this guy's even more popular than I thought. And the popularity seems to be specifically that he's a posthumous influencer. That people who are themselves influential in conservative, philosophical, literary, political circles are moved by and inspired by this man who used to say, oh, there's nothing wrong with fascism at all. This man that used to say liberalism is moral syphilis. This completely based, ostentatiously provocative extremely right-wing man who basically kind of makes Nietzsche and Nietzschean ideas and pagan ideas fascinating and inspiring and fun and brings them to life. And he is the secret little shot of whiskey engaged in by the overtly teetotal church lady of the mainstream far right, or whatever you want to call it, the acceptable far right, the GB News far right, the reform far right. But yet those people are influenced by him, those people like him, those people, and even people in the Conservative Party, are fascinated by him, his spine-tingling orations and just his incredible ability to transport you to this world, to this England, where England lives and will live in the future and will triumph over the decadence, and where ultimately the power of England will out in the end. And it's as if she carried it around in her handbag as to sort of remind her on her darker days, when she's sitting on the tube and there's foreigners listening to music without earphones just to annoy you and show disrespect to your country, where there's weirdos with purple hair and pink hair and God knows what, where there's men dressed as ladies and ladies dressed as men who want you to accept them as what they are superficially or whatever, all this insanity, that it reassures you, like carrying the Book of Psalms around, that it will all be okay in the end. And I found that's his purpose. That's what Bowden is, an influencer. And of a very particular and inspiring kind, not least because he had all these qualities of the charismatic. He had identifiable flaws, which often seems to bond people more with people. People have an identifiable flaw of being short and fat, in his case, or being extremely impoverished and poor and living in a decrepit caravan. It makes you seem more genuine. It makes you seem more that you've sacrificed more for the for your beliefs, like living in a barrel if your Diogenes the cynic. It bonds people more to you. And then he made the ultimate charismatic sacrifice by dying, and dying young. And this cements you as a kind of prophet figure for then what becomes a growing group of followers, a charismatic in normal times, within his lifetime perhaps, is just dismissed as a crank. But as life becomes more riven with crisis, then the crank gradually turns into the charismatic for a larger and larger group of people. And I think all of this has somehow happened in relation to Bowden. My biography of him is warts and all. It looks at, I mean, he was a liar. He was a unstoppable liar and aggrandizer of his own background. There were all kinds of flaws. But then the thing is that you would expect a charismatic to have exactly those flaws. Charisma is associated with basically being highly intelligent combined with essentially dark triad traits, narcissism, which means you have this, you ooze confidence, and thus you inspire a sense of confidence in others, grandiosity, entitlement, and those people will tend to lie. So we really shouldn't be surprised by the flaws. Or Bowden himself said that geniuses, and I think he was a kind of oratorical genius, are like special needs the other way around. They're brilliant in some aspects of life, but they're appalling in sort of basic aspects of life. And that was completely true of him. He was financially incompetent. He never worked, really. He just lived off his father. He lived in a decrepit caravan. He couldn't drive. He was never a bachelor, childless, created this whole fantasy marriage and seven children, all nonsense. In a certain aspect of life, he was totally useless. But in one aspect of life, clearly, in terms of inspiring people, being a sort of based prophet, he was quite amazing. So that was the background of it. So then I got in touch with Michael Woodbridge, who is the executor of his estate, to whom he left everything, and interviewed him. And he told me all kinds of fascinating details. And then he put me in touch with other people, Eric Galati, who, for example, who is a Italian-American actor who lived in the UK, and he had all kinds of, and then he put me in touch with other people, including someone. Bowden was in a group called the Spinning Top Club, which was a group of basically right-wing artistic people that would get together in London once a month or so. And this, he ended up, Bowden ended up taking over the club and being in a physical fight with its founder, who I interviewed. And that club ended up becoming the London Forum, where once a week somebody would speak, often Bowden, but often various other political figures on the, as it were, the far right. And then he put me in touch with another actor who knew Bowden, and then I got in touch with a chap called Damien Thompson, who is now associate editor of The Spectator, and he knew Bowden very well because they were at school together, and then he put me in touch with another friend of Bowden's from school, and then put me in touch with Bowden's, with the head of science at Bowden's school, who's an elderly man who is still with us. And it was just through this process. And then so, and then if I got in touch with, for example, Nick Griffin, and then he put me in touch, who's been on my channel, put me in touch with other people, because Bowden was involved with the British National Party and he was its cultural affairs officer. And then other people put me in touch with other people. And then before long, I ended up with about 60 interviewees, the last of which was, I get Bowden claimed to know Michael Portillo. I contacted him. Portillo didn't remember him. He claimed to know William Hague, which he probably did, because they were both in the Federation of Conservative Students in the 1980s, but Hague didn't remember him. Eventually, I was at a conference where I met Michael Gove, and Michael Gove did remember him and was brave enough, I don't know if, I assume Portillo and Hague were telling the truth, but was brave enough to say, yeah, I remember Jonathan Bowden, I do, yeah, I'm a very interesting guy, a very intelligent guy. So he's influencing people at a very high level, and his charisma is such that a lot of them are able or are willing to overlook the dangerousness, if you like, if you, as regards being cancelled by the far left. Oh, he's a Bowdenite, he's a supporter of Bowden, because they're just so inspired by and amazed by and intellectually stimulated by the way that Bowden presented himself and the things that he had to say. And Damien Thompson was his best friend. And when Bowden died, he even wrote a short obituary about him in The Telegraph, in which he said that Bowden had a gift wasted on boneheads, which I think is a bit of an exaggeration, but basically Bowden ended up speaking in these groups, to these groups of about 40 people, above pubs. The intellectual far right, as it were, combined with various other aspects of that group. And these have been preserved, often quite amateurly, as video recordings or just as voice recordings, and have become memes and have spread sort of biblical texts almost across the internet, and been memed and memed again. And you have whole YouTube channels dedicated to Bowden, and whole Twitter accounts dedicated to Bowden. Some people sort of love him because he has inspired them so much. So this just process of this snowballing process just kept occurring. And then I found that a number of people, quite surprisingly, for example, Troy Southgate, who used to work with Bowden a lot, or a guy called David Odeberg, who was his friend, who was professor of philosophy at Reading University, just refused to be interviewed. I suppose because either that it was a time in that, well, you get this a lot with people on the far right, they look back and they think to themselves that, oh, I could have made so much money, I could have been somebody, I could have been somebody more important than I am. I feel that I regret my involvement in what is seen as extremist politics. And they want to kind of forget about it. I think this is what's happened with the guy that was going to write his biography. I think that he, on the one hand, doesn't want to write the biography because this would render him prominent again in terms of being radical right. He wants to just go back in his shell and do his art and forget about that aspect of his life. But on the other hand, he doesn't want to not write the biography because that, or for somebody else to write it, because that would be admitting failure and that would be admitting cowardice. And so therefore he wants to live in this limbo where he's neither writing nor not writing it. I think that might have been what was going on. And you do get, I did get a number of people like that that did not want to be interviewed, and I state who they are in the book. Because I suspect because it, they feel that this involvement in the 90s or whenever it was they knew Bowden had damaged their lives. And they don't want to have to think about that anymore, and they want to just sort of put that behind them. Or they feel that perhaps openly talking about their association with Bowden will damage their lives, and so they don't want to do so. So you got a lot of that. It gave me an insight as well into the kind of people that are involved in what you might call the far right, different psychologies that get involved. So some people, I think, are just the pre-industrial genetic norm. There's just people just genuinely group-oriented, nationalistic, perhaps relatively religious people who are genetically like that to such an extent that they are prepared to non-conform. Family people of that kind. There were people like that. Then you could imagine it just attracts psychopaths. It just attracts people that are attracted to danger, that like offending people, that are attracted to being different. And and those people might also, because of the different subtraits crossover, have broader dark triad traits, narcissism, things like that. And I think that explains perhaps some of the hostility that I experienced from some whom I interviewed or whom I tried to interview. I look at this in the book. Some people are, you know, basically saying to me, oh, what's the point of talking to you about Bowden if you're not going to look at the Jew? This sort of thing. One person I telephoned, Martin Webster, who I've met, and I must have said something that he didn't agree with politically. He knew Bowden. And I rang him up and said, Martin, could I possibly talk to you about... It's Edward Dutton. And he went, oh, bollocks to you, Dutton! And slammed the phone down. So there's those kinds of people that get involved. I think there's people that are attracted to conspiracy theories, and an element of that can be schizophrenic traits, paranoia. There was one woman whom I tried to interview who knew Bowden, and every time I tried, she just moved it back to COVID and to other conspiracies, and argued that it's so. And she had this kind of flat way of talking. Oh, well, should we talk about Bowden? Because, I mean, Bowden didn't understand COVID, and he didn't know the full extent of what the government are doing. I really think it's that we need to talk about. Well, look, surely you were Bowden's friend, and the focus is that I want to get information about Bowden from my book. Yeah, great, but then we're forgetting about the important thing, which is what they're doing behind the scenes, trying to control us and inject poisons into us. And so eventually I just had to abandon the interview. And then you could imagine there's people that have kind of autistic traits, that let's say they hate change, that's going to be a big one, and they like consistency, and they therefore hate whatever the ideology is of the time that is inconsistent. And if that were to be combined with aspects of genetic group orientation and conservatism, then you can see how those people would be attracted to the extreme. So you get various fascinating, interesting people who you can see are not going to get on, which is why there's often so much splitting on the far right, where it tends to be high in psychopathy, or the far left, where it tends to be higher in narcissism, because you want to get narcissistic supply by uber-socially conforming. On that note, I did interview a few people that were on the far left. I caught, there was one guy I interviewed that used to lecture Bowden when he was at university, who definitely is a leftist. And Bowden talked about him being a leftist, but this guy was a kind of a good leftist. You don't get many of them. An open-minded leftist, a person with whom I disagree, but who I respect, and I imagine it's mutual, because he's able to do so logically and reasonably and without appeal to emotion. And I interviewed someone like that, because Bowden, he was a habitual university dropout, and one of the things he used, which, by the way, is predicted by psychopathy, and he just used to hang around the Polytechnic of North London as a de facto, though non-registered, student. There was a lot of this bowed behind the scenes. I went through everything he wrote and everything he said that's been recorded. And there was nuggets, kernels of truth in everything, but it was always exaggerated slightly. He told a friend that he went to Reading University. He didn't. He probably just, in those days, no tuition fees. He probably just turned up and went to a few lectures. He made out that he went to the Polytechnic of North London. He was never a student there. Again, we know what was happening, because I've tracked down his lecturer, which is that he was there for years, just hanging around the campus, going to lectures, stimulating his mind. Remember, in those days, in the 90s, there was no internet or anything like that. So how did you stimulate your mind? Well, it was books and things like going to lectures. There was no internet. There was no internet like to watch Bowden doing YouTube videos. You had to go in person to things. And that's what he used to do. And it seems that he used to go in person to a few engineering lectures at Manchester University, to a few geography lectures at Reading University. And he would tell people, he would exaggerate slightly and say, oh, well, I studied there, which is not quite true. So there were people like that, people on the left. It was very hard to find out what was going on in his youth. I suspect he had a mental breakdown. You'll see in the book, he had to retake his A-levels, things like this, and he was very secretive about this. And he would just tell all kinds of lies to groups like the Monday Club and whatever. So I found people just didn't like him at all. They just regarded him as a total liar and a fraud. Didn't see the good side of him at all. And then other people that were aware, they were all aware, because when he died, they started to compare notes, that he was a liar, but also just saw the good in him. And there were a lot of people to whom he was very close, and he was obviously capable of love and of saying so. And as for girlfriends, there were two women that seemed to have possibly been girlfriends of his, but neither of them would write back. So again, there was this embarrassment. There was this feeling of putting it in the past, of putting that their nationalism, their period of prominence 20 years ago, in the past, and not wanting to talk about it. And in many cases, I thought I'd do little pop biographies of these people because they were so interesting. And there was one person, a former BNP activist, that when he discovered I'd done this, quite by chance, he really objected to it, even though all the information is out there and is public. He did not like, and said, if you're going to do a mini biography of me in the book, then I don't want to be interviewed in the book, get rid of my stuff. Because he felt it was raking up the past. So there was a lot of that behind the scenes, of some people not liking raking up the past. And the worst example was dealing with his family, or his step-family. So his father died in the same year that he did. He had no brothers and sisters. And so what you're left with was a stepmother and three step-siblings. And none of them would talk to me. None of them would write back. And I went to great efforts. It turns out, from Michael Woodbridge, the stepmother and Bowden just hated each other. Absolute hostility. And when Bowden went to hospital in Market Harbour and asked her to visit his ill father, the stepmother was in the room, as was the stepdaughter, and they walked out without speaking to him. Total hostility. And I made every effort to speak to them, because, of course, they would have had unique information, which nobody else had. But no reply. And eventually, I just sent someone to the stepmother's house with his girlfriend in tow to sort of make it less intimidating. And it turned out she had dementia. So she's born 1943 and she had dementia and she couldn't really talk to them. And the stepsister refused to do so. So you can see the step family are just normies. If you look on their Facebook page, it's pray for Paris, it's take the injection, you know, it's all this stuff. They're just normies. And they obviously find it quite horrifying to be related. I found out his stepsister's daughter, and I managed to find out online what pub she worked at in Market Harbour and left a message at the pub. But nobody would get in touch. And so you can, there is this sort of, so this result is that his early years remain, because only this, the only person alive that could know this would be the stepmother, and she would have told, and the siblings, that they just wouldn't speak to me. So you can see this clash. Imagine being Jonathan Bowden. His father was this very normal, ordinary bank manager that was involved in every civic organisation you could imagine. and his step siblings, these very everyday normie people, and you have a relative like Jonathan Baum, it must be fairly shocking. So I look all of these people anyway of various different kinds, and I managed to pull them together, and then of course I was able to find all kinds of information in old newspapers, various points at which Bowden was prominent, and bring it all together really, and that was that. But that was the key difficulty, was that certain people just did not, which I find it amazing, if someone I knew was having a biography written of them, I would do everything I could to help. But no, they did not want to. They see him as an embarrassment. They see it as a bit shameful. And you've got to remember that he died in awful circumstances, young. He then had a pauper's funeral. The family didn't even bother to organise the funeral. And they were concerned that the far right would come to the funeral, but yet they weren't prepared to go themselves. And so in the end, people just turned up, because a funeral in England is a public event. And there was about 30 people there. None of his family, none of his stepfamily even attended his funeral. And because of the way in which he wrote his will, there was no access to his money. And so it was a pauper's funeral paid for by the council. There was not even a vicar, just the funeral director. And then he was cremated. So it was an ignominious end. Although weirdly I discovered, and God knows how this happened, on the site of his old school, which had now been pulled down, they've named a road after him. The council have named a road after him in Reading, Bowden Row. So I don't know how that got through. Extraordinary. And then when I was finishing the book, I even at that point, I didn't understand the interest there would be in it. I put out a tweet about how I was finishing the book, and it got about 1,000 likes, and loads of people got in touch with new information. So I suddenly had to do a quick rewrite right at the end of the process. So I'm very grateful for everybody that contributed with and got in touch with me because of various announcements where I've talked about writing the book over the last few months, with new and often quite important information. People with information on his family history, which I didn't have, or people with information just because they met him, and various remarks he made, and all this kind of stuff. And so it's been a fascinating roller coaster ride. And I hope this video just gives you a bit of an insight into the background of writing such a book. And then I pitched it to a particular publisher, and they accepted it straight away, which was again an indicator of how much interest there is in the guy. And we'll go from here, and I hope it is of use. So do buy the book, and do tell me what you think, and I hope it's all of interest to you, and goodbye, and we're not sorry.
Are you ready for the future of the West?